You're listening to Equip Season 5, Understanding and Interpreting the Bible. This is Week 3, Apocalyptic Literature, taught by Midtown Pastor Dr. Timothy Paul Jones, an author and professor of Christian Family Ministry. This week's participants are Andrew and Kristen Gish and Jonathan Crum. You're on Session 3.
Well, we're looking at five different questions to ask when you're reading apocalyptic literature. That's what we've been doing over the past few sessions. And how does this text reveal God's beauty? That's one of the things we always want to ask. How does this text encourage Christians to endure when facing pressure or persecution? That's another question to ask in this. How does this text provide Christians with assurance that God is going to make all things right and new? And then last session, we looked at how does this text fit with the rest of the Bible? What connections are there between this text in Revelation or Daniel and the rest of the Bible? And in this session, we're going to ask, how does this text fit into its historical context? Mm-hmm. Because sometimes that's really, really important. And at the end, I'll give you a couple of suggestions of commentaries you can look at to help you with this. Because I don't want any of you to feel like I have to go to a pastor or I have to go to seminary or I have to go get a doctorate to be able to read my Bible. I don't want that for you. I want you to be able to understand and interpret scripture on your own in a great way that you can understand what it has to say. So I want to give you some resources that helps you to understand this. Now, I want to start by just thinking about people didn't stop writing apocalyptic literature all the way back in the first, second century. You think about there are apocalyptic literatures, we might say, even today in the 20th and the 21st centuries. I think about Blind Willie Johnson all the way back in 1930. I love old blues. He's got a song called John the Revelator, which is drawn from Revelation as this very apocalyptic text. But I think even in the 60s and 70s, there were songs like All Along the Watchtower by Bob Dylan, which was covered by Jimi Hendrix. That's an apocalypse. That's all the things we've talked about apocalyptic literature. Almost all of those are present in that particular one. And in some sense, Hotel California by the Eagles is a very apocalyptic text. You've got this guide that somebody takes, is brought along. They're going to this journey into this other place. But one of the supreme examples of an apocalypse in modern times is the song American Pie by Don McLean. Now, those of you who are listening to this or watching this, if you don't know about this song, you should hit pause right now and just go listen to it, American Pie by Don McLean. And so what this is a song that is actually about the downfall of popular music, the downfall of rock music after the death of Buddy Holly in a plane crash in 1959. That's what the song is actually about. But it tells all of this in a very cryptic way, filled with numbers and codes and colors and sort of figurative language. All of it, the whole thing is done in figurative language such that Elvis is simply referred to as the king and Bob Dylan is referred to as the jester and the Beatles are a quartet practicing in the park. It does all of these things and it sets it in a context of a football game and a dance and all sorts of things together. It's apocalyptic. It is apocalyptic literature in our own times. Now, here's the reason I'm bringing it up. Imagine that 2,000 years from now, somebody dug up that song and they tried to figure that out 2,000 years from now without looking at what was going on around it historically. You and I both know they would come up with absurd, crazy interpretations of this text if they didn't look at the history going on around that. They would have to figure out what on earth, what would people have meant by the king in the 50s and 60s to do with music? And what could this possibly be? They would have to look at that. And yet sometimes people go to the book of Revelation and they don't look at the history of what's going on around Revelation. They just try to drop Revelation straight into the present day without looking at the history of what's going on around it. Well, that's what we're trying to avoid. We want to help you to be able to look at the history around Revelation as you try to interpret the book of Revelation. Because what you begin to see is that apocalyptic literature, and particularly the book of Revelation, is not intended to be a timeline or roadmap to the end of time. That's often how we read it. It's a timeline or roadmap telling us exactly about the end of time, but that is not the point of Revelation. It's rather something that gives us hope that God will make all things right and new in every age. I hinted at this in the last session. We'll bring it back up again. Why would early Christians have preserved a text if it didn't have any relevance until the end of time? They preserved it because it had relevance and meaning to them in their context. They understood something about it that gave them encouragement in their context. I want to use another analogy of this and have you all jump in and give your perspective on this. Think of political cartoons. Think of political cartoons. They depict different politicians. They use different symbols for political parties. Think of what symbols are used for political parties and political cartoons, the animals that are used and things like that. And I want you to imagine that 1,000, 2,000 years from now, somebody dug up a political cartoon from today that showed a donkey and an elephant. What would they assume about the United States today if they took that literalistically and didn't look at the historical context? What are some things? What might they think if they dug up a political cartoon from right now, 1,000, 2,000 years from now, and they see these things being depicted by these animals and these symbols? What might they come to a conclusion of?
Maybe they would think, if they're reading it literally, that we had, the United States had like really diverse animal life or something, that a donkey and an elephant could be together.
That's what I'm thinking that they would think, is something like that, of thinking that maybe that the way we decided who ruled in any given time was we had herds of donkeys and elephants that went to war against each other or something like that. That's what we would think. And to us, we're saying that, and it's like, that's crazy. Well, exactly. That's crazy, but it's kind of what people sometimes do with the book of Revelation. They take these animal symbols or these color symbols or these numbers, and wanting to take the Bible seriously, they take it literalistically and end up missing the point completely. Just like somebody a millennium from now looking at a political cartoon and concluding, oh, wow, there was much more diverse animal life in the United States back in that time than there is now. They had both donkeys and elephants, and they fought with each other to figure out who would control the United States. It was absurd. Just like it's absurd sometimes the way people read the book of Revelation. As I think about that, I think about in Revelation 13, the mark of the beast. When I was a child in one of these prophecy conferences I remember going to, there were things raised about, there was a ruler of Russia named Mikhail Gorbachev, and he had a birthmark on his head. And it was maybe that birthmark on Mikhail Gorbachev's head is the mark of the beast. And they were trying to figure out, is there a way we can make a 666 out of this? And it's just as crazy, because it's looking at something, trying to take it in your own current context without seriously considering what did it mean in its original context. And so that's why I want us to ask the question, what did this mean in its historical context? And so I am going to look at Revelation chapter 13. Revelation chapter 13. So as we look at it, as we move into it, let's think through the larger historical context in the first century. Rome ruled the known world. Rome was a superpower, an empire that ruled the known world. But not only that, there'd been some things happened over the past couple of decades. We don't know exactly when John's Revelation was written. It could be written as early as the 60s AD, as late as the 90s AD, somewhere in that range. But regardless, there's some things we need to pay attention to. In the year 64 AD, there had been a fire in Rome that began by accident in an oil warehouse, but Nero blamed the Christians for the fire. So Nero blames the Christians for this fire, and Nero begins initiating these localized persecutions of Christians and the pressure on Christians to sacrifice to the Roman gods to show that they weren't Christians. A few decades later, Domitian reigns over the Roman Empire from 81 to 96, and Domitian he begins to demand that people worship him during his lifetime. Now, it had been common for several decades that after a Roman ruler died, he would be declared a god after he died. Mm-hmm. But Domitian goes one step further. He's like, I want to be called Lord and God while I'm alive, not after I'm dead. I want to be called Lord and God while I am alive. So as we think through this, there's pressure from the religious side of things to bow to the political power of Rome. And so that context helps us as we look at Revelation chapter 13. I'll read verses 1 through 3. And I saw a beast coming up out of the sea. It had 10 horns and 7 heads. On its horns were 10 crowns, and on its heads were blasphemous names. The beast I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth. The dragon gave the beast his power, his throne, and great authority. One of its heads appeared to be fatally wounded, but its fatal wound was healed. The whole earth was amazed and followed the beast. Let's just pause right there and think about what we see in this. You have first a beast who has total power. That's what's being indicated here by these 7 horns, this notion of this total power. This is hinting at some empire with total power. Well, what would this have meant in their day? An empire with total power is Rome and the imperial power. But there's some fascinating things going on. There's a leopard, a bear, and a lion. It's got different parts of these. What's that trying to say? Well, to understand that, we have to go back to Daniel chapter 7. These are different animals that are used to symbolize different kingdoms or empires in Daniel. So what is it telling us? The Roman Empire in their day, they were viewing it as the culmination of all of these past pagan powers, we might say. Now, there are ways that the 10 and the 7 can be identified with different emperors in Rome, and that could be, but I don't think it's necessary for us to go there. What's very clear in this is that the power of empire comes from the dragon, from Satan. But not only that, this beast has been fatally wounded, but then healed. The language that is used here indicates and suggests that this is a mockery of Jesus, we might say. Like, this is something that is a parody, we could say, of Jesus. Something that is trying to claim the power and sovereignty that belongs only to Jesus for itself. Well, when we think about that in the context of Domitian, mm-hmm. who is claiming and demanding worship of himself as Lord and God while he's alive, you've got something that helps us to understand an empire that demands total allegiance with a leader who is claiming the authority but also the worship that belongs to Jesus and Jesus alone. We start seeing some things when we look at it in the historical context. Could somebody read verses 4 through 7?
Yeah, I can. They worship the dragon because he gave authority to the beast, and they worship the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast? Who is able to wage war against it?" The beast was given a mouth to utter boasts and blasphemies. It was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. It began to speak blasphemies against God, to blaspheme his name and his dwelling, those who dwell in heaven. And it was permitted to wage war against the saints and to conquer them. It was also given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation.
Well, I want you to notice one thing here especially, and that's at number 42. Now, what we talked about this in the last session. Now, we know in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, 42 is actually the answer to all things in the universe. That's not what it is right here in this. But 42 in this, what did we talk about that 42 implies? 40 and 42 tend to imply when we look at them in the light of the whole of Scripture.
Wilderness and temptation.
Yeah, this time of temptation, wilderness, being brought through testing, all those things like that. So this 42 isn't intended to indicate just 42 months and no more than that of persecution, of tribulation. If that was the case, God was actually telling a lie to these people mm-hmm. because their persecution and their tribulation actually lasted longer than that. Mm. No, it's letting them know that this time of testing, this time in the wilderness, we might say, this time of tribulation that they're going through isn't going to last forever. And then it becomes relevant to us because it's also letting us know that whatever we're going through, mm-hmm. it's not going to last forever. The Roman Empire, everybody mm-hmm. in their day would have thought, in fact, they called Rome the eternal city. Mm-hmm. They thought it was going to last forever. And yet mm-hmm. it hasn't. It doesn't. And that's what is indicated here is the powers that array themselves against God will not last forever. Could somebody read verses 11 through 15?
Yeah, I can get it. Then I saw another beast rising out of the earth. It had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. It exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence, and makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast, whose mortal wound was healed. It performs great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in front of people. And by the signs that it allows to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on earth, telling them to make an image for the beast that was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast might even speak and might cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain.
So what we begin to see here is false religion is trying to press people to give absolute allegiance to a false god. In this case, the emperor of the Roman Empire mm-hmm. is to give allegiance, to give worship to him, and the religious powers are trying to press them to do that. But notice some other things in here, some fascinating things. It's two horns like a lamb, huh? Where else is there a lamb in this book? Well, there's the lamb slain from the foundation of the world in this that is Jesus. Again, it's a parody. They're trying to mimic Jesus. Mm-hmm. They're a parody of who Jesus actually is. And this religious power is trying to press them to give their allegiance to an image of the emperor. It's a side note that's maybe interesting in this. They actually, in the temples of this day, they would do things to make the images in the temples move and breathe fire and all sorts of things like this. And many, many people believed that these were supernatural events. Like they would actually make the statues in the temple so that they could move different parts of them in response to certain things and fire and things like that. They were really good at this. This is something that actually happened. And so it's saying that they are not only mimicking, parodying Jesus, they're actually trying to give life to that which is dead. But it's fake. It's false. It's empty is what is being declared right here. Verses 16 through 18, if someone could read that.
He also forced everyone, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark in his right hand or on his forehead, so that no one could buy or sell unless he had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of his name. This calls for wisdom. If anyone has insight, let him calculate the number of the beast, for it is man's number. His number is 666.
And this is the point that is really crazy, that a lot of people have a lot of crazy things that they think about this. But notice what we've already seen in this text, that if we don't read this out of context, but read it in context, we can see that the theme that's going on is trying to press people to false worship, and that you've got an unholy trinity of a dragon and two beasts that's an unholy trinity that is directing worship towards something that is a parody of Jesus. If you start thinking about this, maybe this can make a lot more sense. Mm-hmm. Now, there are a couple of different ways I'm going to talk through in this. Remember, in their day, numbers also functioned, or letters, I should say, also functioned as numbers. So a letter functions also as a number. So alpha, beta, gamma, we could go through the Greek alphabet. Each of those is also functioning, can function as a number. So one way of reading this, and I don't think it's entirely wrong to consider this, is that there is a way to take these letters and take them into Hebrew and then move them into their numeric values such that the name of Nero ends up adding up to 666. Now, certain early Christians clearly thought that this indicated Nero because an alternate way of doing that, you land on 616. And guess what? Some manuscripts of the book of Revelation have this as 616 instead of 666, clearly indicating that there were early Christians who understood this to be Nero. So I certainly think that's possible. But I don't think it's necessary for us to do that with this text. I think it's very possible, but not necessary to do that with this text. Remember, in this text, everything is this imitation, mockery, parody of the true God. And remember that, as we've already talked about, six is falling short of the good, the complete, the perfect. Remember, seven indicates that. Six is falling short of that, such that we might think about the Holy Trinity would be 777 because it's utter perfection to the third power, we might say, or three times of the Father, Son, and Spirit. And so what do we have here? A dragon, a beast from the sea, and a beast from the land. 666, falling short utterly of God's perfection over and over and over. At three levels, falling short of God's perfection. Now, there's a couple of different ways this term can be translated. When it says that this is the number of man or the number of a man, it could mean one of two things. Either this means this is the number of a particular man, which might be something like Nero. But there's another way that I think is probably preferable to understand this text. This is the number of humanity. This is the number of mankind. And what it's indicating, if we read it that way, is 666, falling short of God's glory, that's as good as humanity gets. It's as good as we ever get. Is falling one short at a threefold level, we might say, of the glory of God. That's what's being indicated here. And so in this, the greatest empire that the world had known, the one that controls the world, the best it can produce is still falling short of God. And it is calling you to treat as completion and perfection something that actually falls short of God's glory. 666. That's what I think is being indicated right here. But what about this whole thing about the forehead and the hand? My goodness. I remember as a kid being taught all sorts of things in churches that they were going to put a UPC code. When UPC codes started going on the stuff at the grocery, we got really scared because those UPC codes somehow were connected to the number of the beast. And someday they were going to put UPC codes on our foreheads and on our hands. And we were all really concerned about this. What on earth? Well, we need to go back to Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 8. Where when the word of God is given to Israel in Deuteronomy 6:8, it says you bind them on your hand and on your forehead. Now, later on, the Jews, they actually started tying scripture in a little box called a phylactery to their forehead and their hand, but that's not actually what that text meant. What that text meant when it says bind them on your forehead and hand was the way you direct your life, your head, and the way you act and the way you, what you do, what you produce in your hands, and what you direct as the direction of your life, head, hands. When it says that they are expected to put the mark of the beast on their forehead and on their hand, it's saying the way you direct your life and the work you produce ends up being done directed toward false powers and false gods. If you bow to Domitian, if you give in to giving a sacrifice to the gods of Rome, if you do that, what you are doing is the way you direct your life and the way you do your work is now directed toward a false god. And it will fall short of the glory of God. Now, as I said before, when we start reading it this way, I think we get so much more beauty and richness from these texts. So much more beautiful, so much richer. And no, it doesn't tell us, and I don't think it's intended to tell us about the details of the end of time. It doesn't tell us that. But it tells us a lot more. It tells us, how do I live in a world in which I am constantly being pressured to conform myself to false powers and false gods? Because Rome may have gone away, but the impulses of this haven't gone away. There are still powers in our world that seek to conform us to gods that always fall short of the true God. So it's much better for us to interpret it this way, even for our daily lives. So when you're reading apocalyptic literature, ask these five questions. How does this reveal God's beauty? How does this call Christians to endure when facing pressure or persecution? How does this provide Christians with assurance that God will make all things right and new? Then, what does this mean in light of the rest of the Bible? And then lastly, what does this mean in light of its historical context? Now, as I said at the beginning, I'm going to give you a few resources that I think could be helpful to you in this. One of those is the IVP Bible Background Commentary. It's a really good resource. The IVP Bible Background Commentary is edited by Craig Keener, and it really helps you to understand the historical context of this. Another resource I really like that would be helpful for you to put in your library when you're reading the Bible is called The New Testament in Color by Esau Macaulay. He's the editor of it. The New Testament in Color. It brings together scholars from a wide range of different backgrounds, culturally and ethnically, to be able to understand the text holistically in its historical context. The New Testament in Color, edited by Esau Macaulay. And the last one is the one I mentioned all the way back at the very beginning of these, is that book I wrote that I got all that mail from all the weird things. Yeah. But it still might be a helpful book for you nonetheless. It's called The Rose Guide to End Times Prophecy that I wrote back then. And I said I would never teach on the end times again, but here I am. And so I would commend that book to you as well as a possibility for taking a look at to understand the historical context that we're looking at here. Thank you.